Morning. Sure is good to see everyone. We're going to have scripture reading. We'll be reading from Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. And God said, "Let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heaven, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every moving thing that moves upon the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the likeness of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them.
Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. And we're going to continue on talking about trying to figure out who we are and trying to answer the question of who am I. And I think the passage in Genesis 1 there, it really needs to start there, because can you and I in any way know more about ourselves than God knows about us? Who makes us? Who made us? It's a little bit like, you know, the potter and the clay, and the clay trying to tell the potter, well, you can't make that out, you know, me. And the potter always knows best what to do with the clay and what the clay is. The clay doesn't determine itself. The potter determines the clay. And so for us to understand who we are is primarily something that we need to hear God. Last week, and just give you a little reminder of last week, I kind of introduced this idea of searching for who we are with reminding us of lessons I had done 9, 10 years ago, and about trying to live a blessed life and trying to be content and happy and to essentially try to unite your expectations and reality. So sometimes we have to learn about reality in order to align our expectations with them. But in that process, that was not my suggestion, but a psychologist, a God-believing psychologist, and he mentioned just take the five things that identify you that are the most important in your life, and you need to water them and feed them and tend to them if you want to really be content and feel joy. But in that process, he talked about trying to fill out the answer of, you know, I am blank. And what is that that I am? And there's a lot of things you could list there. And I took you through kind of my own list. But that really begs the question, does all the things that I do or the roles that I have, and my list, you know, started with I'm a child of God. I tell people, you know, they want to know about me religiously. I said, I am devoted to Christ. And that really defines, for me, that is the ultimate definition of being his follower. Whatever that means and wherever that takes me, that is my commitment. And so, but then, you know, other than that, you know, we're sons and daughters. We are husbands and wives. We are siblings. We are workers. We're managers. We're, you know, employees. We all kinds of roles throughout life that we fulfill. And we try and do those, hopefully to the very best of our ability, do them as we would for God. But are those things, do they define us? Does that say who I am? And so as I mentioned last week, you know, 40, 50 years ago, the primary thing about me would have been a son, a child of my parents. And you know, as I said last week, the primary thing about me right now is I'm a widower. That defines me more than anything else in my life. Surprised me a little bit in the last number of months that overwhelms almost everything else. But that's just the phases of life that we go through. And so when you think about those things, when you identify I am this, that, or the other thing, a lot of those things change because the things that we're due, the roles we have, they change throughout our life. And so does that alone describe who I am, or is there something else? And that's what I'm going to... Today's just part two. We're going to have at least one more. And I don't know if it'll be one or two. I have a lot of stuff, other stuff written down, and I don't know how much longer it will take to do. But I want to ask you questions to try to help you understand what... I think this is actually a fairly deep question because it has so many layers to it. And so let's start with one of them, coming from the Genesis 1:27. Are we flesh and blood or something more? Now, this isn't a or something else. This is something more. We are flesh and blood. God made us flesh and blood, as Genesis 1 there talks about. That he says he made us in his image, after his likeness. Now, there's a really interesting concept there. We're made like God in his likeness, and yet he doesn't live in flesh and blood. And I can't even see him in person with my eyes and still live. And so there's something about the likeness that's different from this flesh. And there are passages that talk about that this flesh is simply a tent. But this tent was made by God. He made us, and he made us male and female. And that's popular now to kind of pretend they're not male and female, or you can switch it and change it. It's like your genetics are what your genetics are. Your flesh and blood is what it is. I wish I could not be A negative blood type. I don't really care, but I can't change that. There's nothing I can do about that. That was genetically defined for me when I was born. And there's nothing I can do to change that fact. And so the reality of figuring out who we are is there are some things that you and I don't have any choice. Did we choose even to exist? Did we choose who our parents are? Did we choose the time and the place? We didn't choose anything about our existence. We were made. And so, understanding who I am, and especially when we're young, and I think this is one of the great, going to be one of the great tragedies as we look back at some point in the future and we look back on a generation that somehow had been told they could just choose who they are, choose their gender, think about something that expectations and reality. I want to be male, but I'm a female. It's like those realities are very different, or vice versa. And having a surgery to make it appear like I'm something I'm not isn't changing the reality. And in fact, it isn't really helping. Vast majority of the studies show that it's not really helping those who do transition to a different, appear like a different gender. Their suicide rates don't go dramatically down. Their mental health isn't dramatically better. And yet, we've told people, especially young people, they can be whatever they want to be. You might have heard me have told you this. Because, you know, you're young, and you can be whatever you want to be. You know, it's really a nice idea, but it's a lie. You can't be whatever you want to be. You have certain abilities and skill sets. You can be what you're able to be. Right? That's what you can do. You don't have the ability to do everything that exists on this planet. You don't have the ability to do the things God can do outside of this planet. But you grow up, and we say that because we don't want to define you before you've really learned what are the extent of your abilities. And so it's one of those lies that's done with a good goal in mind. But sometimes the reality is you get to life and you grow up and you become an adult and you get into your 30s and go, this really it? Or maybe even in your 20s, you're like, in fact, I think it was a young person that had come to me, somebody had asked me, in their early 20s, I mean, is life kind of like just once you're an adult, like a long list of to-dos? Yeah, it's a lot of it, big portion of it. It's not everything, but it's a lot of it. And that's why so many people have become adults and go, this is great. I spent all my childhood, can't wait to be an adult. And then I realized it's not so great. So Matthew 22, Jesus kind of hinted at this idea that we are something more. And in this passage, the Pharisees had, I guess I'm going to get to the right passage. That would help. The Pharisee or the Sadducees had questioned the idea of a resurrection. They didn't believe it. So there were a number of Jews who didn't believe there was a resurrection. They believed all the blessings were just happened in this world. And, obviously they were all wealthy and powerful. That's why they thought, hey, look what we got. We must be great because we're wealthy and powerful. And so they were questioning this idea. And they basically posed one of those difficult hypothetical questions that they felt Jesus would never be able to answer. And they were posing it based upon the law that said, if a man married to a woman, but he dies and they don't have any children, that his brother is supposed to marry her so they can raise up children to inherit his stuff, right? Not the uncles, but the fathers. And so, but then all that happens. So it happens seven times. And they're like, oh, well, in the resurrection, whose wife is she? They're like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. And he's like, basically, you don't know what you're talking about. That's what his answer to them is. He says, start in verse 29, Jesus answered them and says, you are wrong. Very first words out of his mouth after he posed the question. You're wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. So you don't really know what scriptures teach, and you don't really know the extent of God's power. And he says, for in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. So human beings, after we've died, are not in this male-female role anymore. And a marriage kind of role anymore. That we become like angels in some way. I don't know exactly what way that is. I don't know the extent of God's power. I don't know the extent of, we can look at other passages, like 1 John 3 and things. That we don't really know what we'll be like when we are not male or female. But someday that will be true. It's not true today. But now there's a part of us that's still like God, isn't it? But not every part of us. And so, figuring out who we are, sometimes, you take kids and you're like, in fact, somebody was just telling me, or not somebody, I was just watching something where somebody described how they had taken their young child to a doctor, and the doctor was asking this, I can't remember if it was a little boy or a little girl, are you a boy or a girl? Well, you would think the doctor would know. And yet, this little child is being asked to understand itself. You're 20 and struggling to understand yourself. Most people don't really get themselves until they're like 30. What we're doing to little kids, it ought to be a crime. There is no possible way these children can possibly understand the concept of knowing what it means to of who I am, my existence, the essence of who I am. It's a deeper question. And so one of the other questions, and so today's going to be a lot of questions where I want you to think about before I start answering, I think, the deeper ones. Am I what I do or what I'm able to do? And let me give you just a quick concept, for example. I really love watching shows and things that find an old car, you know, 40s, 50s, and if it's sitting in somebody's garage, some rich person who could just park some fancy car in a garage and cover it up and then not touch it for, you know, 6 decades, and, you know, they go, oh, maybe we should sell it, and somebody comes along, and you're like, well, you can't start it. It doesn't run. Is it a car or not a car? Is it just a hunk of metal? Is it just a bunch of parts and some leather? Or is it a car? Doesn't run, can't. I love to see them restored. I love to see those things restored and make them work again. But it seems like a real simple, oh, yeah, it's a car. Yeah, but you can't do anything with it other than sit there and look at it. Well, is that the definition of a car? Isn't an automobile, a vehicle, supposed to transport you someplace to another place? So there's what I do, but there's also what I'm able to do. And those aren't always the same thing. That's why people tell young people, you can be anything you want to be. So you can find the extent of your abilities. So you can go out and try to, you know, be on the basketball team, and then, you know, you play a couple years and go, well, that's probably not for you. That's not going to be your thing. That's okay. You'll find your thing. So my abilities are not the same thing as what I actually do. But am I defined by what I do? In some ways I am, aren't I? What defines me as a sinner? Our theme from a couple years ago. It's what I've done, right? I'm not born into the world. Oh, look at that baby. What a sinner. But at some point, we go, what a sinner. What I do often does define me. How I act, how I behave, whether I control myself or don't control myself. All those things become defining in a lot of ways. But there's also what I'm capable of. Does that define me also? Sure seems like it, right? In John 8 there, in the passage where Jesus, you know, is talking to a lot of the Jews, and he's telling them that the truth will set them free. And you know, he's telling them, I speak what I have seen with my Father. And you do what you have heard from your father. Now, when he said that, they would have been looking at him like, okay, he's Jewish. They even knew him. They knew who his father was. I mean, and they could have traced it all the way back to Abraham. But they knew who his at least legal human father was. And his mother was. And where he grew up. They knew those things about him. But they also could trace their lineage all the way back to Abraham. And so when he told them, he says, well, you know, I speak what the Father tells me. And he basically tells them, and you do what you have heard from your Father. And they're like, well, wait a second. We all had to have the same Father here. Because the concept of your Father for them would not have been your immediate Father. It would have been the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And so like, Abraham is our Father. And Jesus said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. That is not what Abraham did. You are doing the works your father did. And so notice that he has taken this idea of identity from just a physical sense, and now he's transposed it a little and gone in more of a learning sense, a spiritual sense. They're not really doing and acting like their father. They're acting like their father, who is the devil. And that's going to shock them. And so they become children of what they do, of who they follow. And so he goes on, he tells them, you know, if God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. Well, what is the devil's desires for you? Have you ever wondered that? They're doing, he said, you're doing what your father desires. He hasn't told them yet, the devil, but he's going to tell that in a second, and then they'll get really mad. But what does the devil desire for you? Do you think you can answer that question pretty well? I don't think it's actually that hard. I think the devil would go something like, do whatever you want to do. Do what makes you feel good. Does it please you? You ought to do that. You know, if something hurts, don't do that. If something's painful or sacrificial, don't do that. Do whatever makes you happy. That's what the devil would tell you. Walk down that big wide road of just pleasing yourself. Because after all, that's all that really matters. And so if you do that, you can follow the devil. It's really easy to follow the devil. You just have to follow your heart's desire. But then, and so when he says, you're of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, does not stand in the truth, because there's no truth in him. He is the father of lies, deceptions. And one of the biggest complaints he had about, especially the leadership in Israel, was that they were all hypocrites. They were pretending to be one thing and acting very differently when people couldn't see them. So he goes on, whoever is of God hears the words of God in verse 47. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. Now God made you, but you're not of him. How can God make you, but you're not of him? Right? This is what makes this identity, this idea of defining ourselves and understanding who we are, a challenge. In 1 Peter 4, in verses 10 and 11, Peter wrote, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as God's stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks as one who speaks oracles of God, whoever serves as one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him belong glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Romans 12 kind of talks about the same thing. Whatever abilities, whatever gifts you have, whether they were spiritually gifted to you or not, or some kind of miraculous spiritual gift, or whether you were born with those talents and abilities, use them to glorify God. So Paul wrote, Peter writes. And so there is a sense that I need to know, what can I do? What am I able to do? I ought to use what I'm able. That's important for me, to fulfill my purpose and why I was made. So a couple more questions for you. Do I choose who I am? And you might look, you could look at a passage like Joshua 24. In 14 through 28 here, when Joshua, kind of his last words to Israel near the end of his life, he says, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so he's telling them, you've got to choose. But am I choosing who I am, or am I choosing who I will be? Who I will follow? What I will do? And if I make that choice, can I unchoose it? I hope it's a good thing we can, because otherwise it'd be kind of hard to repent and come back to God, wouldn't it? But he goes on all the way through here. You know, he says, the people answered, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight and prepared us in all the way that we went and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out before us all the peoples and the Amorites, or the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. So therefore, they went straight home from this assembly and melted down all the idols. Right? No. Lots of smirks out there, because you know they didn't do that. They still had them from their parents. They had been brought. And when he said beyond the river, he's not talking, that's not Egypt. We're talking Abraham being called from beyond the Euphrates River. Their family had brought all those. Just like, you know, Abraham's family brought them, they kept sneaking them down. Abraham didn't want them, but the family kept bringing them. And they didn't put them away. And so Joshua then said to the people, you're not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good. So he tells them the truth. God is not going to like it that you still have all of these idols that you worship. And you're fooling yourself if you think you can call him after him and still keep all those. But they did. And they were consumed. And so they basically said, no, we will serve the Lord. And Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourself that you have chosen the Lord to serve him. And so that witness would stand. So in judgment, God's going to go, well, let's let somebody take the stand here. How about your own testimony about yourself? So I can choose some of what I do. Some of what I do is probably not a choice. I mean, probably almost everybody here has a temptation that they would choose to not have if they were making a choice, right? If I could just decide, I want to have no temptations to sugar, I would do that. Sugar has almost no redeeming value. Even honey isn't very good for you, except in really small quantities. But I like sugar. I wish I didn't like sugar. I didn't choose to like sugar, but I like sugar. And so, hopefully I moderate it. But as I told you last week, sometimes I fail and buy the donut when I shouldn't. And so, some of what we do, we choose. Some of what we do, we fall into. We fall into the temptation of. And a lot of that, as scriptures and other places talk about, that has a lot to do with our flesh. Because our flesh is made to desire not only food, but sex, companionship. It has all kinds of desires that in many ways, and almost all the desires can be fulfilled in a godly way. But our desire doesn't care if it's godly or not godly. It just wants it. And so the challenge is for us mentally to try and control and beat up our bodies so that it falls under our control of what we choose to do. That, by the way, is one of the points that Paul is making in 1 Corinthians 9 when he talks about beating his own body to bring it under submission. Because his body, in many ways, is his enemy. That's all of us. The thing that we need to protect ourselves from most is us. It's not other people. It's our own desires, our own temptations that hinder us and trip us and cause us to fall. Other people can be hindrances too, but you're your biggest hindrance. And so, but does that define, if I choose to follow God, does that alone define who I am? Or will I discover who I am? In John 9, go back to that passage. I skipped through it too quickly. In John chapter 9, starting verse 35, and many of you hopefully know this passage. John 9 is one of the great chapters. It's applicable in so many things. But he and his disciples, they run across this blind man, born blind. He didn't become blind later. And his apostles are kind of, they ask him the question that has confused them. Because they look at somebody with blindness and they assumed that his blindness was the result of sin and it was punishment for sin. That is what their assumption is. And so their question is, well, who sinned? His, which seems kind of weird, because you're born that way. What sin did you commit in the womb? Now, some mothers might go, well, yeah, they did a bunch of stuff to me. But, or it's like, well, but the parents, but you know, we have like Ezekiel 18 that tells us God doesn't bring the punishment to the children for the sins of their fathers. And so they're confused by that. And he kind of basically goes, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Your assumption, he has to correct their assumption that they don't know correctly. And so he goes through the whole thing about the blind man and makes him go wash his eyes. And then makes this blind man by himself go through the whole questioning and eventually get kicked out of the synagogue for saying he's a disciple of Jesus when all the leaders hate Jesus and are trying to find some way to, you know, execute him for a legal reason. Eventually they'll give up since they can't find a legal reason. We'll just do it illegally. We'll concoct, you know, some fake testimony for against him. But he comes down when Jesus, after he'd been cast out, in verse 35, Jesus heard they'd cast him out. Having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered and said, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" You know, sometimes we think the Pharisees, Sadducees, oh, just a bunch of idiots. They were smart human beings. They weren't godly human beings, but they were smart human beings. They understood what he was getting at when he said, I'm going to, those who say they see, I'm going to make them blind, you know, and so they're like, "Oh, are you saying we're blind?" And Jesus said, "If you're blind, you would have no guilt." You think about that. Do we hold somebody accountable who can't see? It's like, why didn't you see that accurately? Why didn't you see that correctly? You know, it's like when I tell people, you know, I'll ask, you know, if I'm out golfing, you know, they use on flags on greens, they use a red flag for the front edge of the green, tell you it's towards the front of the green. You use white or something like that for the middle and blue for the back. And oftentimes the guys I'm playing with, I'm like, you know, I'm like 100 yards from it and they can all clearly see it. I'm like, "Is that red?" And they, I think it's red, but I don't know for sure. It could be blue. It's usually not white, but I can usually tell the difference. And so, I always have to tell people, "I'm colorblind." "Oh, okay." And then you're like, "Well, can you see trees? Can you see the red tea?" Okay. Yeah, I don't really want to go into all the extent of my color blindness, but then, you know, they go, hey, you can't see something that just seems so obvious. Okay. That nobody holds me guilty for that. I mean, you sometimes see, might see the clothes I wear. That's how my mother knew I was colorblind, by the way. She saw me wear stuff, and she went, you probably should be tested. So, and, yeah, I actually had a pair of slacks that had a blue stripe, had a red stripe in them. And I wore for, I don't know, 6-8 years, until somebody mentioned my gray slacks with the red stripe, and I had no idea what they were talking about. Like, what? I don't have a gray slacks with red stripe in them. Sure enough, they had a red stripe in them. Because if you put a magnifying glass on a piece of red, I can still see it. But until you, this idea that, you know, we don't hold people guilty for what they're unable to do. So if you say you can see, and if you understand, then you're responsible. And so that's what he's telling them. If you're blind, if you're really blind, you wouldn't be guilty of doing anything wrong because you wouldn't understand. But now you say, we see, we understand, we know what we're talking about, we know what's right. And God said, okay, then your guilt remains with you. Because I told you, and you didn't listen to me. And that's really where a lot of our guilt comes from, is an unwillingness to hear God. We don't always understand all of it, right? Even Abraham didn't. But hopefully, as we grow in life, we learn and grow in that. Well, we're going to stop here for now. And we're going to go into, I'm actually going to look at Jesus. I'm going to apply this to Jesus, a lot of these kind of questions and ideas. And if we think, well, who is Jesus? If we were to try and define who Jesus is, by the way, that is essentially, in doing that, that has for 2,000 years essentially been a big religious argument. Because it's not that easy. And so we're going to look a lot about what Jesus says he is and identifies, you know, what identifies him. And then we'll try and look at that. How does that apply to us and the things we do, but also the essence of who we are, far beyond the things we do or the capabilities? Because even capabilities alone, it really isn't enough to define who we are, is it? It's like a lot of us know the Flemings, right? They had their last child, Down syndrome boy called Winchester. And it looks like a little cutie pie in all of his pictures. And I've known, baptized a Down syndrome adult who had the mentality of a little kid before I moved here. And, but she was the third child of the couple. And in many ways, she was really the bright light of their children. And that didn't mean their children weren't talented and smart, good, hard workers. Even then, you know, some of their kids, good families. But their Down syndrome daughter who couldn't do much was a light. And her love and what she was much more than her abilities. And that's true for all of us. Regardless of what we can do, we're valued because of what God was willing to pay for us. That tells you how important we are to him. And so we're going to end here with their song, 768, Jesus, Let Us Come to Know. And as we do this, we just want to encourage everybody, please reach out to us if we can help you, if we can serve you in any way. Let's go ahead and stand and sing.